questions and comments from the audience. So as Gil introduced on Wednesday, CMB experiments are now moving beyond their traditional role of mapping the density and velocity perturbations in the primordial plasma by going to higher angular resolution. They begin to be able to probe the nonlinear evolution of the growth of structure. And some obvious examples of that, of course, are the blind cluster searches through the Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect, and also the search for looking at the residual power spectrum left over from the SC effect in the power spectrum of the data, which he mentioned yesterday. But there's also going to be a lot of exciting science to come from the possibility of a rich correlation, cross-correlation science one can do with high angular resolution CMB maps. And of particular interest and excitement will be using the CMB lensing and looking at correlations of that with other tracers, because, of course, the CMB lensing is sensitive to mass fluctuations all the way back to the surface of last scattering. So those cross-correlations can probe high redshifts in an interesting way. So I am indeed going to talk about large-scale structure in the context of ACT, and I decided I would turn the lights off so you can see this great picture that Mark Devlin took of the sky above the ACT telescope. The telescope is sitting inside this large ground screen, and you can see that even with a certain amount of oxygen deprivation, you can see the Milky Way really quite clearly. And the Magellanic Clouds, yeah. So ACT is a very large collaboration, and the U.S. part of the project is funded by the NSF, and this is a recent author list that we have. And we're really quite an international collaboration with significant contributions from our international collaborators, and for example, from the UK, Canada, South Africa, and very importantly from Canada, where we have some critical roles being filled by CETA and UBC. Okay, so here is a précis of ACT. It's a 6-meter off-axis Gregorian telescope, and on the left is a ray trace of the optics. The 6-meter primary is made out of 72 aluminum panels, which we align to about 25 micron RMS. So the light enters that blue thing is the receiver, it's cryostat, and inside the cryostat there are re-imaging optics which focus the light, if I have to use the hockey stick, they focus the light onto three different arrays of transition edge sensor bolometers that run at 300 millikelvin. Now, these arrays are unusual for the field of CMB because they're not individually optically coupled. So what you see here is one of the three arrays, and it looks like a flat plane. It's 32 by 32 detectors, kind of like an old-timey CCD that's flat, and the light is coupled in through high index of refraction lenses. And each of the three arrays is at a different frequency, 148, 218, and 277 gigahertz, and each has its own reimaging optics. So the arrays do not observe the exact same area of sky simultaneously, but the two lower frequency arrays are next to each other. So when we scan in azimuth, they do cover essentially the same amount of sky. Here's a picture of the site so you can get the feel for what it's like to make observations there. We have our office in this shipping container, and the telescope the telescope sits inside this large ground screen, and there's also a large co-moving ground screen mounted on the telescope that's rather difficult to see here. So, the site. Yes, it's located in the Atacama Desert. That's the name. And the actual site is right here in northern Chile at the nexus of Bolivia and Argentina and Chile, and actually not too far from Peru, and it's quite near ALMA and TBI site. So an advantage to this site, aside from the fact that it's high, 5,200 meters or 17,000 feet, and very dry, the median precipitable water vapor during our observing season is about half a millimeter. But a further advantage to this site is that it's at minus 23 degrees latitude, which means it's able to look at regions of the sky that telescopes in the northern hemisphere can also look at. So this is a picture of our 148 gigahertz beam. This is, the black lines are showing 10 dB contours. So, and the color stretch is made to magnify the effects that are out here at the 40 dB level. So we've measured the beam very, very well by observations of planets. And there's about a 1.4 arc minute resolution at the lowest frequency and closer to 1 arc minute for the other two frequency bands. The array sensitivity at 148 gigahertz is 30 microkelvin root seconds. And the typical time constant of the detectors can be parameterized in terms of the frequency of the 3 dB roll-off of the filter response, which the median is about 84 hertz for these detectors. No, the earthquake, this last earthquake was far enough away that we didn't, I believe, even see it in our encoders. There was an earthquake about a year and a half ago, which we could see in the telescope encoders. We collaborate with a number of Chileans, but very few of them are from Concepcion. And we don't know anyone in the area who was impacted, luckily. Okay, so to orient you to where we've taken data, here's an image of the sky in galactic coordinates with the South Celestial Pole right here. And the areas which are accessible to ACT, which ACT can view, are shown in light gray here. And shown in blue is the region that is going to be covered by the ongoing SPSS BOSS survey, spectroscopic survey. And this green stripe is the Sloan Stripe 82. And the red fields are the BCS fields where there's optical imaging. So where we have taken data is illustrated in the remaining colors, yellow, orange, and purple. So we've divided our time approximately evenly on this thing that we call the southern strip at minus 55 degrees declination, and another strip, which is along the equator, which we call the equatorial strip. We took data in 2007 with only one array, and then 2008 and 2009 with all three arrays working. The data that we have in preprint form so far is only from a subsection of the 2008 data, a region in here of about 220 square degrees that represents about two effective months where we've, because we spend half the time in the equator, half in the south. And it represents about two effective months at one frequency over 200 square degrees. But as I've said here, we've so far taken about 14 months of data at three frequencies and covered about 1,300 square degrees. So we have a rich data set remaining to be published. Okay, so for one of our focuses from the beginning of designing ACT was to be able to make very good maps of the sky. From there, we would both make power spectra and look for non-Gaussian effects, such as the existence of clusters and sources and lenses. So some of the features that we have which are meant to make that easier are the large ground screens I already mentioned, which help eliminate scan synchronous pickup from the telescope beams observing the environment. We're able, since we're not at the pole, we're able to observe patches in first the east and then the west as they rise, the same patch of sky rises and then sets. And that gives us the ability to have cross-linked maps, which is very valuable to us for closing the loop on getting a good map solution. What else do I have to say? Oh, in doing our analysis, we use all the detectors in each band at once, which is a benefit because each array is about 22 by 24 arc minutes squared. And when we do the map making, we solve simultaneously for the celestial map and nuisance curves And more on that in just a sec. Okay, so this slide is in praise of Cynet. It describes our Mac making. So our approach, which is different from other approaches in the field, is to actually go right for a maximum likelihood map and an unbiased estimate of the true sky. And I put up the algebra just in case you'd forgotten it or not seen it recently. So if you model the time stream as a vector D, which is equal to a pointing matrix multiplied by the true sky, M, plus a noise, where the noise covariance is big N, then the maximum likelihood estimate for the map is M prime, given by this algebraic expression, which you can use, and we do, the preconditioned conjugate gradient method to solve in an iterative fashion. And that's what we do, and it's very difficult, and it would be really difficult without Cynet. So just some numbers, we get about 200 gigabytes a night because we have 3,000 detectors, we take data for 10 hours a night, 400 hertz sampling, it just adds up. The data that in the ACT Southern chip that we've analyzed for the power spectrum so far is about 3 terabytes, while the map is only 200 megabytes. So you could just say that what John Sievers does over at CETA when he runs the map making algorithm is merely excellent data compression. He runs a fully parallel map mapping code on Cynet. He can tell you how fabulous Cynet is. It's one of the top 20 fastest such systems in the world. And for us to make a map in one frequency, if we go up to around 1,000 iterations, it takes something like 10 CPU years. So it's quite a staggering task. So I mentioned the nuisance terms, which we solve for simultaneously. And so here's a little discourse on that. This is a picture of the raw time streams for 6 of our detectors over the course of 5 minutes. And they've been arbitrarily shifted upward to make an attractive rainbow-style plot. And what you see is that they look really, really similar to each other. And to orient you, up at the top is plotted the position of the azimuth encoder of the telescope. We observe at fixed elevation and just scan back and forth in azimuth to keep the overburden of the atmosphere constant. And that's the time scale at which we're scanning. We go about plus or minus 2.6 degrees every 8.2 seconds. So clearly, there's a common mode in the data that's really large. And that's due to the fact that all the detectors observe essentially the same atmosphere, because although the beams end up being separated on the sky, very distant from the telescope, as they emerge from the telescope, they essentially overlap. So what we do is, while we're solving for the sky map, we also solve for the 10 most significant eigenmodes of the set of detectors, the roughly 1,000 detectors, at each instant. And those 10 modes, they remove the atmosphere common mode, gradients, they remove detector correlations, which we have along rows, which unfortunately in our camera are oriented vertically, scan synchronous effects, and so forth. And we've tested halving the number of modes and doubling it, and that does not affect the power spectrum result. The last thing we do is every 10 minutes we remove the mean and the slope from each detector, and then we don't do any other processing in the time stream. So that summarizes how we make the map, and here's an output from it. This is a zoom in of a 4x4 degree tile of the 148 gigahertz data. We believe that this represents an unbiased estimate of all the modes in this region, give or take, from L of about 100 to about 10,000. So the atmospheric structure has a typical size of about 2 degrees, and you don't see it in this map because of the way that we have process the data, and also because of the fact that we have solved for a cross-linked solution. The CMB structure is about 1 degree, and so that's illustrated here. I looked at Gil's talk on the web, and I know you've seen a similar picture, but this one's in color, so you know, let's focus on it. So here's a cluster. They appear in our map as objects of size between about 1.4 and 4 arc minutes. The 1.4 arc minutes, remember, is our resolution. And so sources, of course, by definition, appear as objects of size 1.4 arc minutes. That's what this looks like. So the way we treated the data from the maps to get our first power spectrum, which has been, which is out in preprint form in Fowler et al. In our case, is the following. We took part of the southern strip indicated here. This is the map of the southern strip. This is a difference map from one half of the data versus the other half, just to give you a sense. Over the same region, this is the sensitivity in microkelvin arc minutes. So we take that map, we divide it, we actually create four maps by splitting up the time stream in four segments so that we can make four independent maps with different atmospheric and detector noise contributions. And then the way we create the power spectrum is we only use cross spectra. We additionally divide the map into 13 tiles, 4x4 degree patches. And so for each of those patches, we have four maps, and so we can create six cross spectra. So we get six cross spectra in 13 patches. And we calculate the cross spectra via the adaptive multi-taper approach from Doss, Hajian, and Spergel, 2008. And we report the weighted mean of the cross spectra. And we estimate the errors by looking at the scatter among the patches. And we also verify the errors analytically, as described in excellent detail in the preprint. OK, so here, just to give you a nice visual, is what the two-dimensional cross-power spectrum looks like. Okay, so this is similar to the Fourier component in the y direction and the Fourier component in the x direction. We've taken this, and it's missing its units. I apologize. But we've taken its units and multiplied by L. So we've multiplied by the absolute value of the mode in order to emphasize the angular variations. Otherwise, the plot is dominated by radial variation. And the result is that the two-dimensional cross-power spectrum is quite isotropic, except in this vertical region right here. So we cut out this vertical region from the power spectrum because it's contaminated with scan synchronous signals. We thought for quite a while about clever ways to just get rid of the scan synchronous signals, and then we realized that doing this gives us very little impact in our errors, and it's much easier. So this is what we do.
Atmospheric variation, like that.
I have another slide later which will make that very obvious, if you don't mind. But they're kind of rays that are roughly 45 degrees.
So you don't see atmosphere here, or is it you're averaging over it, that's what you don't see?
No, we don't really see the atmosphere in the spot, no. And by the way, you may be saying, perhaps this is why you're asking, gee, it doesn't look that isotropic because there's like more stuff in those four quadrants. But if you see, there's more red and blue. And so the fact is it's noisier there, which is the sense in which you see the atmosphere. So in the directions where it's more difficult to get the map solution, it ends up being noisier.
Related question. So you're cross-linking, but why do you just have a strip along particular L? So if you're scanning in one direction, then you do get this contaminated mode in a particular direction, but you're cross-linking. So I wonder why you blocked out only the strip along L Y and just nothing along L X.
It's because we scan, yes, no, I can't answer your question.
I can answer.
You can answer.
If there's any magnetic pickup at the splits, for instance, so we're scanning like this, we're scanning like this across something, but the sky is always moving just along RA. So anything constant with
So that is not atmosphere.
No, that's definitely things like magnetic pickup in the splits. Any ground split over would look pick up, and that's
great.
That's right too.
Thank you.
Excellent. Okay, so here is the result, which this is our power spectrum. This is a little inset shows that although for the paper we get our primary calibration from looking at planets, in particular Uranus, we are able to cross calibrate to WMAP from the map itself. So from the actual maximum likelihood map, which we generate, we can cross-correlate that exact map with WMAP to pick out the calibration. That's a work in progress, and I should have written here it's going to be published as Hajian et al. 2010, the definitive measurement of the calibration from WMAP. This is a picture of one of our null test spectra that comes from differencing pairs of the four submaps. We don't seem to have any problems in those regards. And he already showed you this plot where we have the where we've done the fitting to different components, including the ASD and a point source contamination. So I won't spend much time on it. As you know, we have limits and not measurements of ASD. So at the 95% level, ASD being less than 1.63 in the case where we don't include correlated point sources. Just to complete the picture, we, of course, also fit for the residual point source contamination in there. And you can see the results here, the amplitude of the residual. Well, when we fit to this form, which is logical because white noise would go as L squared since we, as people do, multiplied the vertical axis by L squared, we find a magnitude of 10 or 11 microkelvin squared. And just to comment, these point sources, residual point sources in there, the amount of residual point sources that we have depends on what our internal point source detection threshold is. And for us, it's about 17 millijanskis, much higher than in the case of FPP, because we have a larger, more shallow survey. And the residual point sources for us include the dusty star-forming IR galaxies that Boob was just talking about, and also include leftover radio galaxies as well. Okay, so someone asked the other day, why do you use that really big binning? Wouldn't it be more delightful if you used smaller binning? So here is a preliminary image of our next generation ACT power spectrum. It's from the exact same map. It's just different post-processing of the map. And the curves which are plotted on here are the same as the curves that were plotted on the other one. But we just have a lot higher accuracy. And you can see we're really tracing out all the bumps in one experiment all the way down. That's I said L of 100 to L of 10,000. And just in case your eyes being guided, yeah, we run. So here, so your eyes aren't guided. Do we still see seven peaks? We do. I mean, it's amazing.
But how does this compare to what's already around, like Quad and Akbar? I mean, do you have a lot more sky than them?
Do we have a lot more sky?
Well, so how does that compare to Quad?
They don't go nearly as high in their published results. I have a plot hidden behind some other plot. I can show it to you.
Joe Duncan has done some preliminary parameters, and I think we get slightly smaller error bars for the spectrum, but we will plug Akbar
in. So
but good to hold on like that. As far as we think, naturally, it's final.
So, carry on. I'll ask her then. But,
all right, so moving on, we have this great map, and now something else to do with it besides power spectrum is to recover clusters and point sources from it, and so we do a rather standard process of using matched spatial filters, just to remind you again, in case you haven't thought about it recently. For example, when we're trying to remove point sources, we model the temperature in the map as a point source amplitude times the beam response function plus some background temperature. And the background temperature has lots of interesting stuff in it for other reasons, like the CMB and also the noise and the SD effect and so forth. So what you see here is a piece of the original map. This is what happens when we apply a matched filter. And here, Toby Marriage made this great slide where he's just picked out both a cluster and a source from the same map. Of course, when the match filter that we use for clusters is takes into account the expected form of the cluster, unlike what I showed there.
So just for kicks, this is just showing you what we actually use in summing up all the terms that come into T background in considered in Fourier space. We include the CMB, undetected sources, unresolved SC from FIT that you just saw on the ACT power spectrum. We get those spectra. But we also include an estimate of the noise. And when we do that, we use the full two-dimensional autospectrum of the null map. Okay, so a null map comes from taking the data and dividing it in half and creating a map from each of the two halves of the time stream. And this is an image of what the auto spectrum looks like. And this is different from what was plotted in the other one. This is actually L squared CL and the log of that quantity. And this line is drawn at L of 3,000. And what you see here is the following. There's some residual 1 over F, and so you're seeing that fall off. And then there are these rays, okay? So the there are two rays for each of our scan directions, one which is along the scan direction and one which is orthogonal to the scan direction. So there's this piece, and it's coupled to this piece, and then there's this one, and it's coupled to that piece for observing in the east and the west. And that's because we have these correlations along the rows as well as correlations along the azimuth direction. What else to say about this? Yes, well, it grows as you go out because of the L squared factor. And I don't think there's anything else about that. Perfect. So just a picture of a few of the, some of the ACT SD clusters. These are clusters that have optical conformation, and the ones with blue boxes are new, and the fraction of new clusters is about 50%. And these, as you can probably tell, are from the filtered maps, not these images from the filtered maps. And again, this comes only from the 148 gigahertz data taken in a part of the southern strip in 2008. It actually comes from a region that's 455 degrees squared instead of roughly 220 degrees squared. That's a superset of that region. Part of our team has been hard at work at optical follow-up. Menento et al., Felipe Menento and Jack Hughes and others set up this optical follow-up experiment to test the purity of the ACT sample, and they applied for a total of 10 nights at a variety of southern telescopes. Two of the nights were lost to bad weather, but they got 8 nights with G, R, and I imaging down to an R magnitude of 24.5, roughly. And they confirmed 23 clusters from 450 degrees squared of the ACT southern strip. And this is a picture of SOAR. This is a preliminary estimate of the mass threshold that was made by Jack Hughes, showing the mass threshold to be something like 7 times 10 to the 4 m10. Yes. I don't remember how many they looked at. They started with a list of 100, but they had half an hour per, so I guess we can figure that out. But they went down to low signal to noise. So the
So they were trying to figure out the purity, and what they discovered was that you can trust it to signal to noise of 5 or 5.2 for some reason was the official number. I forget to turn off the lights again. So here are some of the new clusters that were found in the run, and they're really, you know, even I, who am not an optical astronomer, think they're pretty cool. They are, isn't that great? So they're at a variety of redshifts. I think two of the new clusters are at a redshift of above 0.8 from photometric Z's from this data, and we've spectroscopically confirmed a few, one or two of the new clusters. We have XMM observations approved for follow-up, working on VLT and Gemini spectroscopy and deep imaging. We hope to get SALT spectroscopy later this year,
And we have a Chandra and HSD proposal, and so that's a, yeah.
Each other, would you call the cluster, or?
No, because it's, yeah, because it's a decrement, like 148 gigahertz.
I bet it, yeah.
I thought you were asking a different question, which is, why do you have a cluster and it has a point source in it? This is just a really brief plot, because we already have improved versions of this plot, of the differential source counts from ACT. So the 148 gigahertz counts are shown in red here. And the models that are shown, the solid line is a model of radio sources from Topolati that's been scaled by a factor, given the shape. And the other two models are some models of what's going on with the infrared detectors. The basic point that I wanted to remind you of is that the radio galaxies, you know, increase in this direction, and the infrared galaxies increase in that direction. So this is why we, in ACT, have not seen a huge preprponderance of these dusty 7-millimeter galaxies, because of where our flux limit is, about 17 millijanskis. So the resolved ACT point sources are dominated by radio point sources, as confirmed by comparing to the ACT 20 gigahertz survey. So there's a two Marriage et al. Papers in preparation, one on the clusters and one on the source counts, and they should be out soon. Okay, so moving on. That was the well-known cool things about high-resolution CMB maps, and now I want to move on to things which are still in the future, although, again, I did look at Gil's talk and see that he has already primed you all for discussion of the gravitational lensing, but, again, with slightly different figures. So I'll try not to say too much about it. So, as you know, the presence of matter along the line of sight from here to the surface of last scattering can deflect the CMB photons en route to S. Typically, a typical deflection size is around 3 arc minute, but the convergence spectrum peaks at about L of 50. So large and small scales are coupled, and you need to have a map where that you believe on large scales and that you believe on small scales and whose pointing you understand, and it gives you quite a lot of requirements. What's shown here is the difference between the lensed and unlensed CMB in a 10-degree by 10-degree patch from the simulations that he discussed yesterday that are in Seagal et al. 2010, and they originated with a simulation of the gravitational lensing on the full hemisphere, done by Das and Bode in 2007. So more on the recovery methods which we're using on the ACT data is given in Das, Hajian, and Spergel 2008. Okay. So we do believe that we will be making a detection of the lensing from the existing ACT map that I've been discussing, which is only from a subset of the data. But another fact is that lensing rotates the CMB polarization E modes into B modes at small angular scale. So looking for the lensing in the polarization is particularly attractive, because while there are fascinating primordial B modes, hopefully detectable due to inflationary gravity waves, and I spend about half my life looking for those, there's no primordial source of B modes aside from the lensing. So you have this clean slate in which you can look for lensing. So for ACT, we've proposed a new receiver called ACTPOL, which will have polarization sensitivity. That's the name. And it will also have about 5 times the current sensitivity of our 150 gigahertz receiver. And so we have proposed it to the NSF about a year ago, and we are waiting breathlessly for them to figure out whether or not the economy has really crashed or is only partially crashed. So here's a plot that I apologize for how busy it is, but it shows the deflection field spectrum, the deflection field spectrum on a log-log plot is shown here in blue, and then
what's plotted are the sensitivities that you get from, I don't know why that's labeled EE. That should be labeled PB, I guess. But anyway, it shows the sensitivities you get from considering the correlation, just the EE data, but then also considering other combinations such as TE, EB, and et cetera. And we predict that with part of our data that we will get in the future, so using one array of 640 feed horns with a new type of detector from NIST for one season on ACT on a 100 degree squared survey area, we'd have a map noise of about 1.7 microkelvin arc minute. And for that, we would have a total signal to noise of about 34. Of course, these are not complete simulations with all realism in yet, but it shows that we're starting from a really good basis. We have forecast, again, without modeling all systematics, that we could get the sum of the masses of the neutrinos to something like 0.07 eV, which is exciting in the neutrino physics world because it could rule out the inverted mass hierarchy where the atmospheric neutrino is more massive than the solar neutrino doublet. If we don't rule out the inverted mass hierarchy, we would rule it out by only being able to set a limit on the sum of the masses. But if we don't rule it out, then we would actually be able to measure a finite value for the sum of the neutrino masses if our estimates on the errors are, our forecast for the errors is reached. Okay, and in what I believe are my remaining 5 to 7 minutes, that's what my clock says. I'd like to talk about just very briefly the cross-correlation science that's possible with ACT. So getting back to this coverage slide, the region in light gray is that which is viewable by ACT, and as I mentioned, it overlaps with regions that Northern Hemisphere telescopes can look at, and here's the BOSS survey, and as I mentioned before, the Sloan Stripe 82 survey. So BOSS is the Baryon Oscillation Spectroscopic Survey from Sloan 3. And just going to give a short précis of its goals, it's ongoing, started in the fall of 2009, so 5-year enterprise. It's going to cover about 10,000 square degrees, admittedly, ACT not. And it's going to get spectroscopic redshifts for 1.5 million galaxies out to redshift 0.7, and also make measurements of Lyman Alpha for us of 160,000 quasars at high redshifts. So the benefits of overlapping with BOSS are the following. It will permit ACT cluster IDs. It permits cross-correlation of the CMB lensing field to LRGs, where the GRAIL, as I'm sure you know better than I, is to trace out the matter power spectrum at different redshifts in more detail. It permits calibration of the mass to gas relationship in the Lyman alpha for us, which allows you to probe structure, as I said, at high redshifts, since the Lyman alpha for us goes to high redshift. This is an idea that's in Valenodo et al., 2009. And so you correlate the Lyman alpha for us with the lensing from the CMB. Additionally, I think this is an idea that's been discussed here multiple times probably. You can correlate the KSZ and galaxies, so effectively tracing out the velocity field by looking at the galaxies with a fairly high signal to noise, and that is usually referred to as the term allowing you to search for the missing baryon, since the KSZ traces the electron density in the environment of clusters, while the thermal SZ is annoyingly multiplied by the temperature. So of course you have an annoying factor of the velocity in the case of the KSZ. However, if you have the galaxies to give you an estimate of the velocity. Then if you stack everything, you can hope to make a measurement and actually be able to find some of the baryons that we believe from WMAP and other measurements must exist, but have not yet found. So that's an idea that was recently presented by Ho, Dedeo, and Spergel, and I think it has come up earlier as well. And finally, I really can't say too much about this, but it also permits measurement of the bias as function of scale of galaxies which are tracing to BAO, i.e. from BOF or maybe some future experiment like ADEPT or SNAP or something. And that allows you to get another handle on the growth rate of structure. Okay, so in summary, or I seem to put us right back on time, the near-term prospect for ACT, things that we are actively working on right now, are analysis of the 218 and 277 gigahertz data in that same region where we've done the power spectrum. This will allow us to improve parameter estimation and increase our cluster sample purity and a number of other exciting things, so we're quite keen to do this. We're also beginning analysis of the equatorial strip data in all three frequency bands so we can really get started on all this great cross-correlation science. And we're hoping to begin construction of the ACT full receiver. We've actually been working on the detectors in an interesting collaboration among NIST, Princeton, Colorado, and Chicago. So those of you who are aficionados will know that Colorado and Chicago are both involved with the SPT. So we've all been collaborating on detectors for next generation polarization sensitive instruments in a collaboration that we call TRUCE. So we know a lot about the detectors and they're very good. And we've also started the optics science lab. No, we have fun when we have our meetings. The last meeting, I found a picture that said TRUCE, but it had like these gang members with tattoos. So here's the end. At least it's the end for many of you. So thank you very much.
Okay, so you mentioned lensing. I guess you were looking for 4-point function, but you haven't shown any results. How is this progressing? Are you needed there, or?
Well, I think we probably feel like it's 1 month out and have felt that way for 6 months. Sudeep Das is working on that vigorously, and he's training a student to work on it with him, Blake Sherwin. So I really can't give you an estimate on what I'm doing.
So, because the other thing is that lensing also smoothens the peak, so you can, in principle, get a cross-check by looking at how smooth the peaks in the power spectrum are. And given you have so many peaks, so high zero noise would be an interesting exercise.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, I didn't include a plot showing how incredibly tiny that is, but you're right, we do go out to high L, so that's cool.
So do you have, which parameters does it help? Have you done your cosmological analysis? Do you really constrain anything much further than you did so far?
With what?
With your power spectrum at low L. Oh,
so John is intimately involved with that work, which is not out yet.
I have the new one. It'll help with, certainly will help with things like NRA and spectral embedding. I think we get a useful constraint on Y.
Okay. But are these dramatic? Can you give me a preview or a hint?
No. I don't remember what they are.
But
it
can't
be. That's like a really useful one. So I want to emphasize that.
Okay.
But just indicate, it can't be that much, right? There's just not that much.
Something like NRAN actually makes a pretty big difference.
What about hearing abundance?
Right.
Hearing abundance.
Ineffective. Yeah,
those sorts of things.
But isn't current CMB data nearly sample variance dominated out to like LO 2000 over 1,000 square degrees? Akbar and Quad? Nearly, not quite.
Akbar is impressive, but it's not that good.
That's because LO 2000? You don't have the full sky up to LO 2000.
Right, but over their patch, and your area is roughly that size. you don't have...
So I thought Akbar was like 100 square degrees. Are they sample and go
They have a bunch of patches that are each 100 square degrees. But what we were... Well, so we didn't do the analysis because we figured we had to have 1,000 square degrees before we could make any... before we could really beat Akbar and Quad.
Well, the thing that I think you should take away from our power spectrum is we're in really good shape to do the lensing because we're really, you know, we have high fidelity on the modes in the map all the way out, you know, over the full range with no twiddling. There's no, you know, it comes out of the map and power spectrum analysis, and that's what it looks like. So.
There's no
transfer
function. Okay. We didn't hear what Anze said. So you showed us this beautiful power spectrum with lensed power spectrum. But it would be really cool to plot also together with unlensed.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Yeah. I take your point.
Yeah.
So how deep are your maps? Yeah. 220 and 270, roughly?
Not nearly as deep as these, which are a board of 30 microkelvin arcminin. We really don't know on the 280. The 280 is farther out than we would like. We're still rescuing detectors in it. The 220 noise is between 1.5 and 2 times worse, so...
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank Susanna again.